The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist. On this podcast, we explore the science and provide inspiration and skills for living your happiest, most fulfilling, and healthiest life. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Mara George, and we're going to talk about social justice in healthcare, the social reasons that influence health and healthcare, and the need to train and the way the medical system can better serve our patients. And we'll also talk about how patients can better advocate for themselves. Dr. Mara George was born and raised in Erie, Pennsylvania, completed an undergraduate degree at Princeton University, and received her MD from Northwestern University. She left Chicago for sunny Atlanta to complete her residency in internal medicine and joined the Division of General Medicine and Geriatrics at Grady after graduation. Mara has always felt a calling to work for the underserved and has harmony between this goal and her love for teaching at Grady. In her faculty position in internal medicine, she finds satisfaction in addressing both the medical and social reasons for her patients' medical problems and teaching medical students and residents to do the same. Mara helped develop the social medicine program and has served as a course director of the social medicine elective, which she teaches medical students and residents about the social determinants of health, patient advocacy, and cultural competency. She's an active teacher across all levels of learners and recently joined the Osler Society as a small group advisor. She's the co-director for the Community Learning and Social Medicine Elective, or the longitudinal program, and her research focuses on the social determinants of health and ethical obligations of physicians with respect to social justice. Mara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And, you know, you had mentioned that there's really a third pillar in medicine. So we know the pillars to be basic science and clinical science. But health system science is a third pillar. Explain what you mean by that.
So this is a term that the AMA is using a lot right now, the American Medical Association of, American Medical Association. You never say that at one out loud. The AMA is using this a lot and doing research and work and funding for schools to boost this health system sciences. And it's things like population health, professionalism, leadership, really getting students and future physicians to be change makers in the healthcare system and to help fix it from the inside out. And it's so important to be effective, not just to know the basic and the clinical sciences, but to know these health system sciences and to know where you're practicing and how to make changes that are going to better the health of your patients and our population as a whole.
So can you give an example of student engagement and how focusing on health system change can really change the medical school experience, but also make the system better for our patients?
Sure. One of the things that we're doing now with the Community Learning and Social Medicine course is this is a new course that's required, and it's a year and a half, so it's the whole first year of medical school and the first semester of your second year here at Emory. And there's two pieces, the community learning and then the social medicine. So the community learning, we have students from the beginning of medical school paired in multiple sites around the Atlanta community that are really focusing on a lot of things that affect patients' health outside of just the traditional office visit, whether it's food or housing or many different aspects. The students are paired there. They spend 40 hours over the year with this site. And it's been really great to see them engage with the community and get to learn this community and some of the struggles that they face, and then also see these resources that are provided by the site they're at. And they work with that site over the second semester to create something together that betters the health of patients and helps the community organization. The sites are amazing, and it's been really a fun course to be leading.
Yeah, that is really cool because, you know, so much of healthcare seems to revolve around healthcare services, you know, seeing a physician, getting tests done. And there's maybe less of a focus on how kind of the community and the socioeconomics, kind of the world around us, impacts the ability of people to access the system and then the ability to implement what the doctor recommends. Can you talk about, you know, what are these social determinants and how they influence care?
Sure. The social determinants are defined as all of the aspects that affect patients' health outside of the traditional office visit. So things like poverty, race, power, acculturation, gender, many different things that are part of our life experience and really very much affect our health, sometimes more than the fact that we have diabetes. But how are all of the things around us either causing that illness or making it harder for us to control that illness? And those are what a lot of the social determinants are. And I think when you talk about making it effective for patients and addressing these social determinants, it reminds me of this analogy I love from Dr. Darren DeWalt years ago, wrote this editorial. And I grew up loving watching gymnastics. I'm 5'11", so I was never very good at gymnastics. But it's fun to see all of those flips and twists and tricks. But the main piece is sticking the landing. And I think in medicine, this really resonated with me because he described how so often we focus on these flips and twists and tricks. And when a patient comes in and they have atrial fibrillation with rapid ventricular response, what do I do in that moment? And that's really important. But if I have exactly the right diagnosis and exactly the right evidence-based plan, and my patient leaves that office visit and they don't know what I said, they didn't understand what I said, or they didn't buy into it, or they can't afford it, or I tell them to exercise and they live in a neighborhood they don't feel safe going out in, then I've done nothing. And I think that is just such a small piece, is getting the diagnosis and the treatment plan right. And really connecting it with the patient and their life and everything else going on is what allows you to stick the landing in medicine and be more effective.
Yeah, what a great analogy. And when, you know, there's increasing awareness to these social determinants, what are some ways that those barriers can be addressed and overcome?
There is definitely more awareness. And I think as people start to see their scope as not just, oh, I just have to get this piece right, but really are focusing more on effectiveness for many different reasons that we can talk about. I think as that happens, people are seeing, and physicians and people in healthcare systems are seeing their role in addressing these social determinants and a society level. And I think that's really where things can move the needle. You can, as a clinician in the clinic setting, you can talk about a social determinant and maybe come up with some tricks or resources. And we do that all the time. So if a patient can't afford their medications and we recommend a coupon from GoodRx, or they're having trouble with housing, and I use the free Aunt Bertha app that we're starting to use more and more to locate some different resources. That can be helpful. But really, on a bigger system level is what we need to make those changes to help so that people are not having those issues to such a degree coming into the clinics. So kind of moving upstream and affecting our society so that there's, you know, I think recognizing food affects your health so much. How do we help with food insecurity? How do we help people have enough but also high-quality food? Housing is a lot of healthcare, and in California they're doing a lot of work on housing first programs and really seeing this as part of medical care. There's a children's hospital that is paying for children's housing because they realized if that's such a big factor, and really doing that up front prevents a lot of the downstream costs later.
And you know, it's interesting you mentioned the investment on the part of the children's hospital, because I was going to ask, to put it in perspective, you know, certainly, as you said, getting the diagnosis is part of the care. The factors that affect the socioeconomics and the access and the neighborhood and the culture are a part of it as well. Can you put in any context, you know, if it's possible to put numbers around it, how much of outcomes, like, you know, if we look at disease or mortality as an outcome, is based on these social determinants?
Well, I think we all think, oh, it's probably mostly that, you know, you're born genetically with this, and then you may have some behaviors you do wrong, and then you get medical care or you don't. And that's And when you break down the factors in that way for preventative mortality, it's only about 10% of the preventative mortality that healthcare affects. Genetics is, I think, 10 to 15%. The behavioral part is a big chunk. And then the social determinants is also a big chunk. And we were talking before, and I think you mentioned very correctly that the interaction between what you do socially and behaviorally and socioeconomic background is huge. So it's much easier for me not to smoke or for me to eat healthier foods than it would be if I were from an impoverished background.
Right. And let's take the scenario that you are a patient from an impoverished background or a lower socioeconomic background. What are things that you should be aware of, and what are ways that you could maybe advocate a little bit better for yourself?
I think that patients don't always realize that physicians often feel very much that they want to help with these issues. And so bringing this up is totally a very relevant thing to your health. I have patients who have hesitated to tell me that they were struggling with housing. And, you know, knowing that helps me to kind of rein in some resources for them, and also to better understand where they're coming from and to know what's going to be a useful medical suggestion and what's not, and really to tailor their care. So letting your physician or provider know what financial things you're struggling with or what other social determinants you think may be affecting your health is a very appropriate thing to do. And then also recognizing that physicians often don't realize the cost. We're almost blinded a lot of the time to the cost of things. It's not like I have a menu of labs or medications that I order and I can say, oh, okay, this will cost this much. So work with your physician to make sure that your treatment plan is affordable. I had a patient once who was on a ton of different medications, and I met her in the hospital when she was admitted with very uncontrolled blood pressure. And we went through all of her pills, and she had so many bottles, and some were old and duplicates and different doses, and there was just a lot to go through. And they said, just throw them out and start again. It's gotten so confusing because so many doctors were adding things to help her blood pressure. And I said, well, is that okay financially if I throw these away and start again? And they said, well, can you just not throw away the clonidine patch? Because that one costs about $400 a month. And my gut dropped. I said, oh, my gosh, your physician's never meant for you to pay $400 a month for this. There's a pill that's $4 a month that's twice a day. And she was already on twice a day and three times a day medicines. And so coming back to, I think she felt like, well, my blood pressure must be so bad that this is where I am and I have to pay this. And just coming back to your physician and saying, did you know that this was this much and is there a different alternative, is very reasonable. And it helps to teach us then that we know some of those costs for future patients.
You know, that's such a great point, Maura. And what I will add to that is I find that patients across a spectrum of educational backgrounds struggle with navigating these little healthcare traps. And even, you know, people who may not be impoverished, it's not intuitive. The system is complicated. And oftentimes people reach out to me because learning what is, you know, on their formulary, how their deductible works, the nuances of cost of medications, where a patch and a pill of the same exact drug could be dramatically different in cost, or a short-acting versus long-acting can be dramatically different. And I think increasingly healthcare providers can help with the navigation piece, not just dealing with illness or prevention, but meandering and finding what you need within healthcare has gotten complicated enough that, you know, you're almost like a tour guide as a physician, kind of showing people, you know, all the different stops and how to maybe get the most out of each. So that's a really, really good point. It also dovetails with, I think, a lot of the work that you do around health literacy. And can you first just explain that term, health literacy?
I think one of my mentors, Dr. Ruth Parker, is nationally known for health literacy and does some great work and has taught me a lot about it. I think the way that a lot of us used to view it is that you assess someone's health literacy and then teach to that level. And now we realize health literacy is a problem for everyone. And it's less about, so the definition is, do the skills and abilities of the patient match the complexity of the healthcare system? So am I, as a patient, do I have the knowledge that I need and the background that I need to be able to engage and move in a good way, effective way, through this healthcare system? And it's less the first half of that problem that's the problem. It's less that patients aren't resilient and resourceful and knowledgeable, and it's more that our healthcare system is so overwhelmingly complex. As a physician, I have been in a place where I felt like good health literacy was not happening, and I was getting confused. And so I see these things with my patients and with my family members and other people in the healthcare system who get very confused by the complexities.
And it's really a two-part problem. So as a healthcare provider, what can you do?
I think one of the things that we teach is simplify things more. Everybody can use information that is simpler. It is wonderful to get a lot of information, and there are effective ways to get people all of the details that they need or want, but start simply. There was a great campaign through the National Patient Safety Foundation, and it was called Ask Me Three. And the three questions were, what do I have? What do I need to do about it? And why is it important for me to do this? So as physicians, I think it's tempting sometimes to tell everything we know about a disease and describe the pathophysiology, what's going on in your body and where, how many people in the population have this and all of these different things. But if you haven't gotten those three questions covered first, that information is not going anywhere and it's not going to be useful to your patient. So recognizing, especially speaking, writing, anything you're doing, simplifying it first. And that includes the language, too. I work a lot with medical students, and they are brilliant, and they are so caring. And I think the more junior we are when we go into a setting, we want to put the patient at ease. We want them to know we're experienced and we're smart. And so sometimes they use what I call interview speak, where you're speaking, you're using higher words. I'm not able to use higher words right now. I'm using twosome. You're using more complex language than need be. So instead of saying, I'm going to percuss on your chest and auscultate, just say, hey, I'm going to tap on your chest and I'm going to listen. And we forget, and they get flustered or nervous and start using these words that are just bigger for anybody. When I go to the doctor, I don't need to hear them say auscultate. And so I think that's another thing to think about. And then the third technique is teach back. And that is such an important technique to use. It is demoralizing to me as someone who, you know, really does try to speak simply and communicate effectively. The process is you teach something to a patient and then you ask them to teach it back to you. So I may say, okay, you have hyperthyroidism, and that is a problem with this gland that's in your neck. And this area is spitting out too much of the hormone that your body has to do a lot of processes. So it may make you feel like you have diarrhea. You know, you do this piece, and then you say to the patient, okay, if you went home and your husband said, what is your diagnosis? How would you explain it to him? And the patient can explain it back. And I've done that before and tried to be so simple and slow. And it was in front of medical students who were watching me as an example. And I said, okay, how would you explain hyperthyroidism back? And the patient looked at me and said, something about my neck? And it's important, because if I just say that information, which is what we so often do, and walk out of the room and pat myself on the back that I've done a good job educating my patients, I have no idea what that patient took in if I don't ask and I don't have them teach it back to me.
Yeah, and that is such a good point. First of all, I love the rule of threes that you mentioned, because I think it's so important to see what is tangibly, you know, something that people can get out of the visit. And then the other part is we don't really ask back to get a sense of how much people remember or recall. You know, my personal habit is I actually draw pictures and write out like a to-do list for people, because I've once heard of all things doctors tell patients they only remember 50%. And that's probably true of a lot of human conversation. I mean, some of this may not be that different from any interaction where if you, you know, the classic is, you know, husband and wife speaking, repeat back what I just said. And then it's like, uh-oh. And so some of this is maybe, you know, we're not always as present and engaged in conversation as we should be. And then that's an art and skill form in itself. But when you ask patients, how much is retained and called back?
It is always less than you think. And what you do as a provider then is scale back again and say, okay, let's start from this point. And then you check, it's called chunk and check. So you don't say, okay, we've talked through the whole visit. What did you learn all about this? But just what are you, can you tell me back how you're going to start this medication? So you just boil it down to a simpler and simpler place till the basic message you need to get across is there. And I'm saying this, I hope this should not sound condescending, because when I go to the doctor, they often don't do teach back on me, but I will do teach back on myself. And this is something I can recommend for the patients out there. And it helps me when I go, I have an orthopedic problem, and I may go and say, okay, so what you're saying is you're thinking that I need this surgery where you would cut the hip here and here and then, you know, and put the screws here, and then that would cause this. And you know, I do that with the pediatrician when I take my children, and being able to say it out loud myself helps me to make sure I'm understanding it and helps them to check what I'm understanding.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said, first of all, that it's hard for us even as physicians, because you know, healthcare is complicated and everything's so subspecialized that even when I step outside of what I do to a different subspecialty, it's hard understanding the need and the culture within that specialty. But as a patient, including ourselves as patients, we can do the, you know, repeat back for ourselves, but what are other things we can do to make sure that we are making the healthcare system what we need it to be for ourselves?
I think I like when patients come with a list, because it's really easy to get to the doctor and forget everything that you wanted to ask. And then you get home and think, oh, I forgot to ask this part. And that can be one of the more important things about your health that your provider definitely wants to hear. So making a list before you go can be effective. Slowing your doctor down or stopping them can be helpful. Doing the teach back, as I said, and then also remembering those three questions. You want to leave with, what do I have, what do I need to do, and why is it important for me to do that? I think that also letting your provider know, I have patients, a lot of patients who don't read well. So if you don't read well, let your provider know. That's not my best way of getting information. I think there's you know, don't be afraid to say, I'm sorry, I don't understand. And then finally, I'll put a plug in as primary care physician. Get a primary care physician that you really trust and who does make sure that you understand and that takes the time to explain things well. I have patients all the time who call and they say, I went to see this specialist and I just need you to tell me what they said. I was not in that visit, but you know, helping to recreate what was going on or answer questions is a great role for your primary care physician.
Right. And when we were talking earlier, you had a specific case about health literacy that you were willing to share. And I'd love for you to share that.
Sure. You know, my family had the same background as I did, grew up together, very well educated, wonderful, lovely people. And I use them a lot in my examples of health literacy because I see this firsthand with them when they're entering the healthcare system. My little sister, unfortunately, was diagnosed with breast cancer a few years ago. And I sat with her through an entire day. And it was just unbelievable what you go through in that first day, the different doctor's appointments and surgeons and tests and geneticists. Was overwhelming. She and her husband looked like zombies by the end. But I was there, and it's, you know, it was easier for me to kind of take notes and follow along. And I remember one of the points, she was talking to her oncologist, and she said, you know, I've been nursing and pregnant for so long now, and do I need to be on birth control while I'm doing this chemotherapy? And he said, oh, you can't get pregnant on this medication. And she said, oh, okay. And he said, you cannot get pregnant on the chemotherapy. And she said, oh, okay, good, I didn't know that. And he said, yeah, you cannot get pregnant on the chemotherapy. And I was sitting there and I said, excuse me, Rachel, you absolutely physically can get pregnant on the chemotherapy. You must not get pregnant on the chemotherapy. And she said, oh. And the doctor said, oh. And he's wonderful. We really, really think the world of him. This can happen all the time in the clinical setting because it's so complex and there's so much going on. And so, you know, being able to repeat back something to make sure. So if she had said, okay, so I don't need to take birth control because I can't get pregnant on this, that would have been a helpful piece to understand if I hadn't been there.
That is such an understandable misunderstanding and so huge. yeah, that's a really good point. You know, I think it also makes me think of sometimes, you know, this can happen to anyone in any occupation. You do what you do all day, all night, and you don't realize that you have to start where someone outside of what you do is starting, you know, kind of unlearn what you know and then, you know, work to where you are. And we just don't do that enough. Yeah, that's a great example. So, Mara, I'm fascinated by how you got to doing what you do. I mean, you are, you know, for people who may not know, just such a renowned teacher here at Emory. This past year, you won a very prestigious teaching award, the Evangeline Papa George Distinguished Teacher Award for, you know, generating the greatest excitement among students and colleagues. And your path to getting here, focusing on social determinants, what was that path?
Well, I think like a lot of us, they weren't teaching about social determinants in medical school. I don't remember ever hearing that phrase until I was on faculty and they asked me to teach it. But I think intuitively, as you work in healthcare, you start to think about them because you have to be effective. And I remember interviewing for residency and going around talking about how I was going to start this clinic that was really holistic and addressed all of these different things like housing and education that all affected patients' health. And I didn't realize I was talking about the social determinants of health. And I remember getting to Grady and thinking, oh, they're doing that here. I'm staying. And that's why I came to Atlanta and why I've stayed. But I think there's so many patients that I think back on, either patients of mine or patients I worked with learners on, that you realize you just cannot move the needle and be effective if you don't think outside the box a little bit. I'll give an example. Years ago, I saw a patient who had COPD, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, a lung condition that happens from smoking, like emphysema. And she had a pretty severe case, and she came into the emergency department, and she was really in distress, and they almost intubated her, putting a breathing tube down her throat and putting her on a breathing machine. But they were able to put her on a machine called a BiPAP, which is just a mask that blows pressure into your mouth and helps with the breathing in that way. And so they admitted her to our service, and we took care of her, and we got her on antibiotics and steroids and all of the things that she needed for this problem. And we sent her home, and she had a BiPAP machine at home. And so she went home to use the BiPAP machine. She bounced back a week later in the same thing, almost was sent to the ICU again on a breathing machine, but reversed pretty quickly with just that BiPAP machine. And she looked better. So we tinkered a little bit more and changed some of the doses and made sure she knew how to use her inhalers and all of the medical things you do, and we sent her out. And she came back a third time that month. And we went to talk to her, and of course the first thought, I shouldn't say of course, you fight your urge to say, she must not be doing what we're telling her to do. And she said, no, I am. I'm using my machine. It just doesn't feel like your machine. And her settings were correct. We had the machine serviced, and it was full of cockroaches. So we were tinkering. I love the expression, rearranging the chairs on the Titanic. Like, you can do whatever dose of an inhaled steroid you want to do for a patient, but if they are going home and breathing in cockroaches, you are not going to fix this. So the most effective thing we could do as physicians, the only effective thing we could do, was to have her machine serviced and then advocate by calling her landlord and kind of encouraging him to get the treatments, the pest control treatment done, so that she wouldn't be in this situation again.
Wow. You know, and when you think, it's such a win-win in that, you know, there's less hospital admissions. It's good for patient care. It's that holistic view is just such an important piece of this bigger healthcare. What does healthcare encompass really? And that's really the question. Right? Where do you draw the border? Is it around the hospital and the healthcare clinic? Is it around, greater and greater ring of community and, culture and all the other things that influence it? What a great example. And before we kind of wrap up, are there things that you want to make sure that people listening are aware of, or any additional things about how being aware of these social determinants can help them advocate for themselves?
I think that, for physicians, I think, if you're not aware, being aware of them and really asking and getting to dig deeper on what's going on with your patient can make you a much more effective physician. And then recognizing how those social determinants play out and their bigger roots in society can make you a really effective advocate. And I think, realizing that as physicians, we intersect with people across society in a different way than I think a lot of other fields do. And I may have a very wonderful, close relationship with a patient of mine who's experiencing homelessness, and being able to amplify that voice in society and say, look, this is something that we need to get right and change, I think can be a good role for physicians. So using your clinical work to advocate for the changes that you see that are needed on a state or national level, I think, or hospital level sometimes, can be really effective. I think for all of us, recognizing that the way we structure society affects our health and everybody's health so much. We live in Atlanta, one of the most unequal cities in the country, and we're in one of the countries with the most unequal balances as well. And there are lots of studies showing that inequality affects all of us adversely in a bad way. So recognizing that, you may be in a very high socioeconomic status, but your health is also impacted, and your society and your outcomes are also impacted by being so split and having such poverty. So recognizing that we're all in this together, and by changing our society in ways that help everyone's health, we'll all benefit.
Maura, thank you so much for all the work you do to increase the awareness and to help train the next generation of physicians so that these types of conversations are a routine part of care, and this awareness just becomes second nature. So thank you so much for being here today and all the great work that you do.
Thank you for having me. This was great.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by Emory Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website, emoryhealthcare.org/livewell. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.